All right, well, good morning. Before we get started and really get going here, I don't have a PowerPoint for you this week. I came down with the flu pretty harsh there for a few days, and it was kind of a struggle just to get this done and the lesson for the main service done. It was kind of touch and go as of even yesterday morning whether or not I was even going to feel good enough to be here, but I feel pretty good now, and so we want to get going here with lesson 21. All right. The notes should be passed out. I think every table has notes on it. Lesson 21. I titled this lesson "The Christian Middle Ages: A Brief History of the Early Middle Ages." There is a lot of stuff that we could talk about, okay? I have books at home that are 1,000 pages just on the Middle Ages, all right? Just on the history of Christendom, on the church, on all sorts of things related to the history of the Middle Ages, 1,000 pages easy, some of the books that I have at home. So to try to take all that stuff and try to condense it down into a workable scenario for this class has been somewhat of a challenge. So we're only going to focus on the points that I think are most significant as they relate to our overall goal, okay, of showing you how the church went into apostasy, and then we're coming up very shortly in the next couple of weeks on spending some significant time looking at groups who were never a part of the Catholic Church during the Middle Ages and what they believe. But before we do that, I feel like we kind of need to do some more to set up the time period, okay? We've talked about the fall of Rome and the rise of the papacy, okay, and the rise of papal power. We did that 2 weeks ago. Then last week we looked at the issue of the true identity of the Catholic Church in Scripture. We spent a week doing that. Now today I kind of want to move on from there and look at some things about the history of the Middle Ages. Now the first topic you can see in your notes is the rise of Islam. Here again, my goal here is not to spend a ton of time going over all the beliefs and all the history of Islam. I'm only doing it from the standpoint of how it affects what we're doing in the class. Okay? So I've got 7 or 8 points here. This could easily be its own class going over the things that Islam believes and so forth. So that's not the objective here. The objective here is to show how Islam interacted with the Catholic Church specifically and how that affects some of the things that we've been studying. So, if you look at point number one under the rise of Islam in your notes, it says, Muhammad lived in Mecca, a small Arabian trading post. There was no large settlements in Arabia except for some on the Red Sea coast, primarily Mecca. Mecca possessed a great shrine called the Kaaba, a black building which incorporated in its structure a mysterious black stone revered since ancient times and possibly a meteorite. Many Arabs who knew Jewish and Christian legends believed that the Kaaba had originally been built by Adam, the first man, and later restored by Abraham, the first Jew. It is commonly believed by Muslims, okay, how many know the five pillars of Islam? In Islam, there's what they call the five pillars, right? There's the confessional statement that says, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. That's fundamentally all you have to say or to believe to become a Muslim, is to say the confessional statement, there's no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. Then you have fasting during the holy month of Ramadan. You have prayer 5 times a day facing Mecca. You have, alms? You have to give alms to the poor, and then the fifth one is once a year, once in the lifetime of every Muslim, if they're financially able, they are supposed to take a pilgrimage to Mecca. Alright? And when they go to the pilgrimage, you've probably seen pictures of Muslims in a massive circle all praying towards this shrine, this black shrine in the center. That's the Kaaba. Alright? The Kaaba. That's what we're talking about here. Okay? So it was a religious shrine that was in the center of Mecca at the time of Muhammad. Point number two, in the year 610, Muhammad claimed that the angel Gabriel had entrusted him with a message from Allah, the only true God. Muhammad quickly began to preach against the idols that surrounded him, i.e. at the Kaaba. At first, no one minded his message, but around
year 622, angry idol peddlers forced Muhammad to flee. Now you can understand, right? We have a scriptural example of this thing in the book of Acts, where Paul is preaching against idolatry, and the silversmiths in Ephesus that make shrines to the goddess Diana get mad and want to have them arrested and all this sort of thing. So eventually Muhammad's preaching against the idolatry that had surrounded the Kaaba is going to affect them to the point where they force him to leave town. Okay? They're sick of it, they're fed up with what he's saying, and their business is suffering because of it, and so they force him to leave. Alright? Number three, forced to leave Mecca for Medina, or Medina, I've heard it pronounced both ways, in AD 622, which by the way is the starting date of the Muslim calendar. He subsequently united Medina and marched on Mecca with a huge army and captured it without a struggle. Muhammad's new religion was called Islam, for a word meaning submission, referring to the need to submit to God. A Muslim then, by definition, is one who submits. All right. So by the time Muhammad died in 632, the whole Arabian Peninsula had been united under Islam. So in 610, he supposedly hears from an angel Gabriel. All right. And if you're not familiar with Islamic teaching, what the Muslims teach is that Muhammad is the final and last prophet. Okay. That the Quran, the word of God, as they call it, that the angel Gabriel gave to Muhammad, is the final revelation of God to humanity, and that it corrects various problems and mistakes that are found in both the Old and the New Testament. Okay? They view Abraham, David, Jesus, all of these as prophets, and Muhammad is the last and final prophet. Muhammad goes back, he purchased the Kaaba, and he recaptures Mecca, and by the time he dies in 632, almost the entire Arabian Peninsula, that would be all of modern-day Saudi Arabia, is brought under the control of the Muslims, okay? Now, just real quick on the story, after Muhammad dies, there is a power struggle within the Islamic world over who should succeed Muhammad, okay? Some are going to teach and believe that the successor to Muhammad needs to be a blood relative of Muhammad. All right? And you can understand why they would want that, especially those that were related to Muhammad, right? Another faction is going to say, no, he doesn't have to be. And so there's a split in the religion, and that split still continues today between the Sunni and the Shiite Muslims, okay? One of the fundamental issues of disagreement between those two Islamic factions is over who should run the Islamic State, okay? So the bottom line is that by 632 at his death, almost all of Arabia is under the influence of the emerging Muslim state, all right? Now, next point. Where are we at here? Okay. Muhammad himself would be honored as a prophet, the last and the greatest in the long line of messengers that the Muslims believed had been sent by God throughout human history. After Muhammad's death, his followers conquered, okay, Arabia, Syria, and North Africa. In 638, Jerusalem fell to the Muslims. And by the year 711, Muslim troops had invaded Europe, conquering Portugal and Spain. Okay? So, last point there, within 100 years of the death of Muhammad, Muslim forces had established an empire stretching from the borders of China in the east to Spain in the west. So Muhammad dies in 632, alright? By 711, that's not the convenience store, okay? By 711, the Muslims have established an empire that in the east stretches all the way to borders on China in the east, all the way across Arabia, the modern Fertile Crescent, the Middle East, all across North Africa. They've crossed the Straits of Gibraltar and attacked Portugal and Spain. And by 711, their empire stretches all the way from Spain and Portugal across North Africa, all the way across Arabia, the Middle East, and touches China in the east. And all of that is done in less than 100 years. Okay? It is amazing. What? The Muslims, the various Muslim caliphates, which is the term that they gave their leaders, this
I don't want to get bogged down in this, but the whole modern notion that Islam is not a violent religion is ridiculous. Okay? Because Islam here is going to be spread how? By the edge of the sword, right? Now let's not get too down here on the Muslims, because the Catholics, as we're going to see by the end of this lesson, are going to do the exact same thing. Okay? But Islam is going to be spread by the edge of the sword. Listen, buddy, you either convert or we're going to kill you. Alright? Now once the Muslims had established reign in a particular area, they did sort of back off a little bit, and they would allow Christians to worship, but they had to pay high taxes to the Islamic State in order for them to have the right to practice Judaism or Christianity in any Muslim land. So, a lot of misconceptions in modern day, in what's going on in modern times regarding the history of Islam. Specifically, also as it's recorded in some of the passages in the Quran. So within 100 years, this is what the Muslims have done. Now remember, Rome has won. Western Roman Empire has fallen, right? So the Muslims have had almost 100 years of unchecked military victory and advance as they've spread the teachings of Muhammad from China all the way into Europe. Okay? Now, if you go to the next Charles Martel in the Battle of Tours, having secured Spain under Moorish domination, now have you ever heard the term Moor before? Moor is a term that is used to describe a North African Muslim. Okay? The Moors is the specific group that crossed the Straits of Gibraltar and invaded Portugal and Spain. Okay? So having secured Spain under Moorish domination, Muslim armies turned their attention north of the Pyrenees to the heart of Catholic France. So, if you're familiar with this is where I wish I would have had time to put the PowerPoint together. If you're familiar with the geography of Europe, you know that the Arabian Peninsula that Spain and Portugal are on are separated from France by a mountain range called the Pyrenees. Okay? So once the Muslim forces have secured the Arabian Peninsula, the Iberian Peninsula there, they're going to cross the Pyrenees and they're going to direct their attention now at attacking Catholic France. Okay? So Muslim armies are going to turn their attention north of the Pyrenees to the heart of Catholic France, and in AD 372, a mighty Muslim army crossed the mountains into the Loire Valley. Okay? Now let's back up for a second. How many remember a few weeks ago when I was talking to you about Clovis and the Franks? Remember that? I talked to you about Clovis, this Germanic warlord he was Frankish, and he converted to Catholicism. Remember we talked about this? And then how he went out and tried to convert the rest of the Franks to Catholicism, again, using what? The sword. We talked about that, right? He sends out a letter and he says, meet me at the river tomorrow for baptism or incur my displeasure. Well, what does he mean? You don't show up and I'm going to what? I'm going to whoop you. Okay? So, there's a Catholic enclave now in what is now modern-day France. Okay? Early on, top of page 2, Moorish armies enjoyed enormous success as they pressed northward through France. Now here's the reality, folks. If events played out in France as they had everywhere else the Muslims invaded, the future of, quote, Christian Europe and world history, for that matter, laid in the balance. Okay? This is a significant event here. Whether you're Catholic or not, whether you have any affinity or affection for the Catholic Church, this is a major deal here, okay? Because if the Franks lose, is there anybody else that's going to stand in the way of the Muslims between sweeping all the way across the rest of Europe? Okay? If that happens, is world history very, very different from what it ended up to be? Okay? So there is going to be a clash now between the Catholic forces of the Franks and these invading Muslim forces that is going to decide a lot of things for hundreds of years after. Okay? Now, Charles Martel, point number 2 now. Charles Martel was a powerful Frankish warlord who had inherited from his father the title Mayor of the Palace, a role a bit like that of a prime minister.
Martel confronted the invaders at Poitiers, or also referred to as Tours, where during a battle the Muslim emir or ruler of Spain was killed. Okay? Now, for my master's degree, I wrote an entire paper on the Battle of Tours, 22 pages. I'm going to make it available to you online if you want to read it. Okay? Trust me, this is one of the subjects that really gets me going. Okay? So I've really cut down here on what I'm going to say about it. But these two armies are going to meet at Tours, at Poitiers. All right? The Catholics are going to kill the Muslim leader. It's going to send the Muslim forces into disarray, and the Catholics under Charles Martel are going to rout the Muslims. Okay? They're going to send them running back towards Spain. They decisively beat them. The sources on the Muslim side say this. The sources on the Catholic side say this. Okay? The ones that we still have left. So, Charles Martel is going to win. Charles Martel is a distant relative of Clovis. Okay? So there's a direct connection there with the Catholics. So, the advance, point number three, the advance of the Muslims was thus checked for a while, and in 379, when they advanced as far as Lyons, Martel's army again routed them and drove them back into Spain. The threat of all Europe being conquered and neutralized, was neutralized. The spread of Islamic power slowed down, and the rate of conversion to Islam became less dramatic. So this is a turning point, folks. The Battle of Tours is what we call in history a watershed moment. Because if it goes the other way, if the Catholics lose, if Charles Martel loses, who else is there to stand in the way of this Muslim army? There's no one else in Europe. Because remember, the Roman Empire has fallen, the Middle Ages have set in, there's total disarray, and the only one really strong enough in Europe at the time is the Franks under Martel to stand up. They win, and as a result, the Muslim presence in Europe is going to slowly start to dwindle. Okay? So this is a high water mark in terms of Muslim invasions into Europe at the Battle of Tours. Now, before we go any further, does anybody have any questions? Okay.
I'm wondering about that black stone, all the things about that. I'm just backing up a little way. Is it still an issue?
Still there, yeah. The modern day Muslim Kaaba is the same site that we were talking about early on. If you go, they bow to this. And five times a day when Muslims do their prayers, they have to face Mecca or face the direction of the Kaaba or the Kaaba.
And the meteorite or something?
So like a big black case with supposedly some meteorite in it, and according to Muslim tradition, Abraham and Adam had something to do with it. There's possibly verses in the Quran about it, but there's obviously nothing in the Bible about it. Okay? If you go there now, Ernie, there's like, it's all covered in a massive sheet that has verses of the Quran embroidered on it. It was like gold thread and stuff like that. It's covered over. And if you want to know about, it's an interesting video. If you want to watch it, do a YouTube video search for the Hajj. One American's Pilgrimage to Mecca. It's called the Hajj. You would ask me that. H, it's an Arabic word. You know what I'll do? I'll just include links to it on the website. So you'll be able to watch. We'll just be able to watch it on the website. When I upload the video, I'll just put those on there. It's supplemental. And it goes through the entire rigmarole that they go through when they go on the pilgrimage. It explains the Kaaba. It goes into a lot of stuff. It's just informational, obviously. Any questions about this so far? All right. So point number four now, page two. Not only was Charles Villiers the savior of Catholic France, but he passed his title, mayor of the palace, onto his son Pepin,
who founded the Carolingian dynasty. Now, guess who's going to come from this dynasty? Anybody ever heard of a guy named Charlemagne? Or Charles the Great? Okay? So here's the deal with Charles Martel. Oh, and by the way, after Charles Martel wins, he is now known as Charles the Hammer Martel. Okay? Sounds like a wrestler, right? So, he not only wins this battle and is billed as the savior of Catholic France and of basically the rest of Catholicism in Western Europe, okay? He also then is going to be the founder of the Carolingian dynasty, which is going to produce Charlemagne. Okay? And you'll see why that's significant as we go through here. So Charles Martel also directly assisted Boniface and other Anglo-Saxon missionaries who were busy among the Germanic tribes of Northern Europe. Since Boniface was acting in his mission work as a direct agent of the Pope, Charles Martel's support of this activity also enhanced the status of Frankish power in the eyes of Rome. So there's emerging here a link between the Franks and France and who?
Rome.
Okay? Who has saved Catholicism? Charles Martel. Okay? Charles Martel's grandson, his grandson is going to be Charlemagne as we go through here. After Charles Martel's incredible victory in AD 732, the Franks felt that God himself had blessed their nation and given them the right to rule. But Pepin III was keen for this to be ratified, notice, by who? By the Pope. And he worked hard at building a good relationship with the papacy. Pope Zacharias endorsed Pepin's claim to the throne, and his successor, Stephen III, declared him Practicus Ramader, or Defender of Rome. So now you have a Pope declaring the King of France, or the Frankish King, as the official defender of who? Of Rome. Okay? So, last point in this section, by demanding and receiving endorsement of the Church, Pepin III helped to increase the Church's power. After all, if the great Pepin required the Pope's blessing to take the throne, then the Pope was clearly a person of note. So this is an interesting development, because who has more power here? If this king thinks he needs to have the Pope recognize him as the king, he's deferring to who? The Pope as a higher authority. Okay? So, we've talked about this, right? How the papacy emerged and how the power of the popes increased. Well, this is another step in that story that we've been following here over the last few weeks. Yeah?
Is there more than one Pepin mentioned here?
Why is that?
Well, you've got Pepin III. Now, isn't that usually three generations of Pepin?
I think there's a situation. Well, yeah, there were some other guys named that, and this guy's in the family line of Clovis, and this is the third guy named Pepin.
Okay, so there's more than one that you talked about. Brian, behind all of this, who paid Western civilization from Michael?
That's a difficult one, because I don't really want to admit it, but you got to go with the Catholics. The Catholics, in a sense, saved Western Europe from Muslim domination. But at the same time, that event cemented them as the preeminent power in Europe for the next 1,000 years. So you basically have an apostate church defeating another apostate religion, and the one group of apostates becoming the one that runs the show, while the other group, at least for that time, begins to dwindle down, at least in Europe.
Okay, ancient Greeks, God is like putting up people and putting down people. In other words, that John left, he knew what was in man. So, do you think God just let man kind of run this out?
I think this is an example of the nature of the dispensation that we live in, where you have the rise and fall of nations, and so on and so forth. Okay, and religion, and so on. You know, and now, if you look at it now, Catholicism, you know, it's interesting. Catholicism is making a comeback. But so is what other religion?
Islam.
okay, in modern times. More and more, the line between evangelical Christians and Roman Catholics is being blurred in our day. I don't know if you knew that or not, but it is. Okay? But to answer your question, you know, the Catholics, you're going to have to say that the Catholics saved, if you want to use that term, they halted the advance of Islam into Europe without a doubt. But again, was that necessarily the best thing either? We'll get to the Crusades don't happen until later. Like, right here, we're in the 700s, 800s. The Crusades don't happen until the 1100s-ish. Okay? Alright, Charlemagne and the Holy Roman Empire. So, Charlemagne, now you're going to see a few terms used here interchangeably. The term Charlemagne, the term Charles, are referring to the same guy. Okay, Charlemagne and Charles are the same guy. It's just a different way of saying it. Or Charles the Great is who we're dealing with here. So Charlemagne eventually succeeded the alliances that his grandfather, Charles Martel, had initiated, and his father, Pepin, had developed. Okay? From the beginning of his rule as king of the Franks in 768, Charlemagne acted in concert to expand his own power and to strengthen connections with the Pope. Okay? Accounts differ as to the nature of Pope Leo III's peril. Pope Leo III I read a bunch of stuff, and everything I read said something different. So I just threw them all in here, and you can take your pick. Some sources say that he was kidnapped by supporters of a rival candidate for the papacy. Some say there was a big riot in Rome, and he was kidnapped, and they cut his tongue out. Some say that he was accused of embezzling church funds. I'm not really too clear exactly what happened here. But he's in trouble, and he calls upon Charles, king of the Franks, for protection. Now, why would he call on Charles? Because Pepin and Charles Martel and that Carolinian line had been declared the defenders of what? Of Rome, and now Charlemagne is the next in line in that family tree, so to speak. Okay? In the year 800 AD, Charles crossed the Alps with an army prepared to settle the Pope's problems once and for all. By the time he came to Rome in 800, Charlemagne's successes against the Saxons to his north and east, the Spanish to his west, and the Lombards to his south, made him lord over more of Europe than anyone since Theodosius at the end of the 4th century. So understand here what's going on. Charlemagne has reassembled a large portion of the old Roman Empire under his headship, under his kingship and dominion. Okay? So Charlemagne has reassembled a greater chunk of the old Roman Empire under his dominion than anyone since the time of the fall of the Roman Empire. So he crosses into Italy with this army with the goal of protecting the Pope. So understand what Charlemagne has done from a political standpoint and a military standpoint. In December, this would still be in the year 800, the king presided over a large assembly of bishops, nobles, diplomats, members of the royal household, and rebels. And on December 23, the Pope, holding the gospel in his ring hand, took an oath, purging himself of the accusations against him. So Charlemagne oversees the clearing of the Pope's name, so to speak, from whatever these accusations had been against him. So that was on December 23rd. 2 days later, on Christmas Day, Charles came to St. Peter's Church, or St. Peter's Basilica, with a large group for Christmas worship. Leo led the Mass, and Charles prayed on his knees in front of the crypt of the Apostle. Charles saw the Pope approach. In his hands was a golden crown. Leo placed it on Charles' head, and the congregation cited to Charles the Most Pious, crowned Augustus by God to the great peacemaking emperor, long life and victory. Now, okay, so let's back up. First of all, what do they call Charlemagne? in that sentence? Augustus. Okay? Who was one of the main Caesars in the during the Roman Empire? Caesar Augustus, right? So notice what it says. The Charles the Most Pious crowned Augustus by who? Well, who's putting a crown on his head?
The Pope.
The Pope. Let me ask you a question. Who has more power in this scenario? Who is bestowing Charles the title of Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire? The Pope is. So you have the Pope crowning someone Emperor. Now, if he can do that, has his power greatly exceeded that of merely a religious leader? Now he is influencing geopolitical affairs in deciding who can be king and who can't be king. You guys following that? Now let's finish that point. The Pope prostrated himself. Charles the Great, King of the Franks, had restored the Christian Roman Empire. Okay? Thus it was that Pope Leo III crowned Charlemagne the new emperor. It only solidified a connection that had been developing for more than a half century. The popes had turned to the north, where a strong imperial household was emerging. In terms of medieval society, Charlemagne never considered himself a vassal of the Pope. Rather, he held himself to be responsible to God alone for the welfare of his people. Now, you're going to have a little bit of a disconnect here. Is Charlemagne going to see this way the same way the Pope does? Uh-uh. Charlemagne is still going to view himself as superior to the Pope, but the Pope is going to view himself as superior to who?
Sure.
Charlemagne. And let's be honest about it. At that point right there, if push had came to shove, who probably literally had more power?
Charlemagne.
Why? Because Charlemagne's going to look at the Pope and say, how big your army? Right? Because who's been protecting the papacy? The Franks. Okay? So, don't get confused. Let's go on. For the next 800 years or more, the politics, learning, social organization, art, music, economics, and law of Europe would be, quote, Christian. Not necessarily in the sense of fully incorporating norms of the gospel, but because the faith of the Western Church centered in Rome had so decisively linked with the new Roman Empire over the Alps. So the Church has now put themselves in a position where they are going to have total authority and total control over virtually every aspect of the lives of the people of Europe as a result of what's going on here. Okay? Now, before we go on, are there any questions about any of that? So the power of the papacy has increased to the point where the Pope is declaring this guy Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And that's going to create a link, okay? And you'll see how that unfolds as we go through here. Charlemagne enforced water baptism by the point of the sword. If you didn't get sprinkled, you got executed. How many of you have ever heard of Verdun? The bloody verdict of Verdun. At Verdun, Charlemagne massacres 4,000 Saxons for refusing to be baptized. Okay? There's accounts from the Middle Ages of the River Aller running red with blood for weeks as a result of what happens here. The Saxons refuse to be baptized as Roman Catholics, and so Charlemagne just massacres them. Okay, 4,000 of them. During the 83-year struggle to Christianize the Saxons, 10,000 of them were driven from their homes, and the war of Charlemagne against the Saxons, notice, was the first church-approved massacre for the extension of the church. Unity and power, rather than truth and righteousness, were the primary concerns of Rome. So here is where's the Pope? Is the Pope saying, you know, you shouldn't really, that's not very Christian of you to go kill these people for not converting?
You know, that's not Did he get the Pope's approval to do this? Do you think?
Oh, yes. The Pope is going to approve of the killing of anyone who does not agree with him. Okay? So this is the first time where you have an official church-sponsored massacre here where Charlemagne goes out and does this. Pick up a book. Read about Charlemagne. Read how the historians cast Charlemagne. You know, they talk about the Charlemagne Renaissance, and how he established schools and he did all these things and he did all this stuff for the benefit of the church and so on and so forth, and they totally skip over the stuff that he did here. This wasn't the only time he does anything like this. He's doing the same thing Clovis did. He's doing the same thing any of these other Catholic rulers did, where they go out, and if people refuse to submit to what the church said, just kill them. Yeah.
What was the Saxon stand?
The Saxons?
Religiously.
Amongst the Saxons, you probably had some who were more Bible-believing people as a result of the ministry of some of St. Patrick's missionaries, which we talked about earlier. But then you also had just a lot of abject paganism, too, where they didn't want to have anything to do with Catholicism. And the Saxons fought back, too. That's why it takes 83 years. The Saxons burned churches. You know, they left Charlemagne. They didn't make it easy for Charlemagne, but he went after these guys with the full fury and approval of the church. Eventually. That's a whole other issue, the whole history of England and the various invasions that that happened on the British Isles. So, Charlemagne's 50 military campaigns against the Lombards, Bavarians, Avars, Danes, Slavs, and Saxons were designed to unite all of the Teutonic and Latin peoples of Europe under himself and a Roman Catholic Pope. Okay? From this point on, the state, now remember Augustine, right? In the city of God, he says that there are two different things, right? There's the city of God and there is the city of, I don't remember what's the other one he says. I don't remember. I have to look it up. But from this point on, the state, the kingdom of heaven, and the church, the kingdom of God, were to work conjointly to bring in the kingdom. But at the inception of this blessed merger, the church was obviously the winner. For the head of the church, the Pope, had just been accepted as God. You saw that when the whole congregation said that Charlemagne was crowned Augustus by God when he crowned him in a previous statement we read. Okay, so the Pope had just been accepted as God, while the reigning emperor of the state only Caesar. Under this divine arrangement, future popes, as top dog, have the right not only to select which king can reign over which kingdom, but also have the right to excommunicate any king they did not like. Okay? Folks, I'm telling you, this is every bit a religious dictatorship. This is an authoritarian rule by a religious state. From henceforth, any ruler who will obey the Roman dictatorship and keep his subjects in line with Roman Catholicism will be a good ruler, while any ruler who allows rebellion against Roman doctrine, teaching, law, sacraments, priests, officials, or councils will be a bad ruler. Okay? Andrew Miller, author of Miller's Church History, comments on the Pope's view of his authority. After he crowned Charlemagne, Miller writes, the Pope sought to reconcile his character as the vicar of Christ with his new position. As all men were subject to Christ, he reasoned, so likewise are they subject to his vicar and representative on earth in all that appertains to his kingdom. But that kingdom extends over all, therefore nothing belonging to this world or its affairs can be above or beyond the jurisdiction of St. Peter's chair. Well, there you go. So if there's a king out here that doesn't want to do what the Pope wants him to, the Pope can do what?
Excommunicate.
Have him killed, whatever. Get him removed. Okay? However, and this is a caveat here, however, until Charlemagne died, the Roman popes could not enforce everything they had planned. Charlie still had the royal flush because he was still an active commander of an army. He presided at the Council of Frankfurt in 794 instead of the Pope, and he continued to appoint his own bishops and abbots without the Pope's consent. If Pope Leo had croaked during Charlie's lifetime, he would have undoubtedly have filled the vacant papal throne with one of his own bishops. So until, as long as Charlemagne is still alive, is there still a very tenuous situation here between the Pope and the new Caesar? Okay? Once Charlemagne is dead, though, is that going to change? Yeah. And we'll see that. Any questions about this so far? Yeah.
So, in terms of looking at all these leaders of these nations are Catholic,
they're going
to
be. They're going to be Catholic for.
They have to be baptized Catholic, right?
They're going to be Catholic all the way until pretty much the time of the Reformation when some of it's going to change. There's a lot of stuff here, you know, it goes back to what we talked about in the second lesson, to what extent, you know, we talked about in the Bible, linear, right? In the beginning God created the heaven and the earth, and God has prophesied what the end is going to be in the Word of God, but as time goes forward, you also have what? You also have the cyclicality of the circle as time moves forward. So you have both phenomena at the same time. Yeah. Well, let's talk for a few minutes about the Christianity of Christendom. The Christendom of the Middle Ages affected the practice of the Christian faith in every way. The medieval synthesis that is sometimes called harmonized, at least in theory, what we today regard as separate, sacred and secular spheres of life. The medieval synthesis ideally symbolized by the cooperation between Charlemagne and Pope Leo, should be the third, was an integrated view of life in which everything, politics, social order, religious practice, economic relationships, and more, were based on the Christian faith as communicated by the Roman Catholic Church and protected by the actions of secular rulers. Okay? The distinctive medieval shape of these convictions was the belief that saving grace comes to people through the sacraments in a social setting defined by the cooperation of church and state. The sacramental system as it developed in Christendom required that the organized church play an indispensable role as the agent through which the sacraments brought God's grace to every state of life. As the sacraments mediated God's grace in Christ to needy sinners, so the church was the sole mediator of the sacrament. The theology of the Middle Ages expanded upon earlier hints to show that Christ had commissioned the church to fulfill its role in distributing the sacraments and designated the ordained leaders of the church, especially the Pope, to act as the successors to the apostles in fulfilling the mandate of Christ to guide his people. So, this is a salvation through what? The sacraments. And who is the only rightful administrator of the sacraments? The Catholic Church, and who's the head of the Church? The Pope. You with that? In other words, with widespread agreement that salvation was the most important reality, and the further agreement that salvation was communicated through and by the sacraments, it had to follow that the Church, as the administrator of the sacraments, should offer a foundation for everything else in life. Okay? In the Middle Ages, folks, quite literally, the church became the state. Okay? Everything in the life of a medieval in the average person in the Middle Ages, from the time they were born to the time they were died and had Catholic last rites administered to them, and they were buried in a Catholic cemetery, from every day in between there was dominated by the thinking of the church. Okay? And the sacramental theology that we're talking about here. Next point. This is very important that you understand this. Herein lay the true power of the papacy and the Catholic Church during the Middle Ages. Since only the Church could administer the sacraments, and the sacraments were a means of grace, Church officials possessed great powers of persuasion, excommunication, and interdiction. Excommunication meant exclusion from taking the sacraments. In the Dark Ages, this was a fearful thing, since all Catholics believed that baptism and continual partaking of the Eucharist were essential for getting to heaven. Their souls would literally be damned to hell if they were excommunicated permanently. So understand, now does the Pope have massive power over someone? Because it is accepted theology and practice that the way you get saved is to take the what? So if the Pope can come along then and excommunicate you and deny you the sacraments, is your very salvation then in jeopardy? And if you are living in a total, utter fear of not taking the sacraments, are you going to then do what the Pope wants you to do? So this is an example of nothing less than spiritual blackmail. Okay? Bishops could excommunicate anyone except a pope, and only a pope could excommunicate a bishop. Meanwhile, the pope was sinless and cannot be excommunicated by anyone. Okay? What? Now, it's always nice to be on the top, right? The other power is called the interdict. Okay? The interdict was a political lever used to pry a king off of a throne if he did not submit to the spiritual, political, or economic demands of the Roman pontiff. Interdiction was a chain of command thing where all priests in a given area closed the cathedral doors and cut off the sacraments for everyone, thereby temporarily damning all people in that area, because the sacraments are said to be the means of grace and essential to the salvation of the soul. So here's the way this would work. Let's say I'm king. The Pope wants me to do something like pay a higher church tax or something, and I don't want to do it. So to put pressure on me, what the Pope would do is declare my land under interdiction, which means all the Catholic priests in that area would shut the doors of the cathedrals and the churches and refuse to give you folks the sacraments. Now, what is that designed to do? That is designed to have you folks put pressure on who? Me, the king, to do what the Pope wanted me to do. You see that? So, read the next point. Only baptism and extreme unciation could be performed under the interdict. And some authors say the unction was denied. While the mass and the rites of marriage and burial were withheld. All Catholics had a deadly fear of not being buried in a Catholic graveyard. This gave the local populace a half-completed salvation, that is, a washing away of original sin, but no mass to take care of daily and weekly sins. Okay? The greatest thing about the interdict, from the standpoint of biblical Christianity, was that it forced political rulers, barons and kings, to use their police forces and armies to kill or imprison Bible-believing Christians in their jurisdiction. The European ruler was faced with the choice of having his own subjects rebel against him, for they would naturally blame him for the closed church doors and lack of sacraments, or he could obey the Pope and kill anyone the Pope told him to kill. That is, the Roman Church by AD 900 had become a religious mafia of professional killers engaged in staying in office. You think that's overstated? Go read the facts. Okay? I told you, I've used this example before. If the Pope really cared about doing things right and cared about truth, would he have stepped in when Catholic France and Catholic Europe are fighting each other during the Hundred Years' War? Does he say one word about it? Why not? Because as long as Catholic France and Catholic England are fighting each other in the Hundred Years' War, who's not threatening papal authority? Catholic France or Catholic England? But in the meantime, if you had the audacity to believe that the sacrament didn't save, that Jerome's Vulgate wasn't the Word of God, that salvation was by grace through faith, and you refused to take the sacraments of the Catholic Church, then you were a heretic, and whoever the political ruler was in that jurisdiction had the right and authority based on papal decree to go have those people killed. Okay? You following that? Alright, last point. The decline into feudalism. After Charlemagne's death, his empire disintegrated due to civil war and the Viking invasions. Charlemagne's empire, you know, Charlemagne was one of these guys who, through the force of his personality, was able to keep this thing together. When Charlemagne dies, though, his sons are a bunch of nincompoops, and they fight amongst themselves over who is the true heir to Dad's empire, and seizing the opportunity, the Vikings also start to invade, and hit and run and tactics and so forth of the Vikings. When the Vikings began sweeping out of the Northland, people increasingly surrendered both their lands and their persons to the many counts, dukes, and other local lords in return for protection. These disintegrating conditions presented a new challenge to the church and to the unity of Europe. We call it feudalism. Okay? Now, understand what's happening here. Charlemagne's empire is corroding. The Vikings begin their invasions. People are scared. The Vikings are ruthless guys, okay? I mean, they kill, rape, plunder, the whole nine yards. The Vikings are doing all that stuff, right? And they come in, and in exchange for protection, people are going to give up some of their land and so forth in exchange for the protection that a lord can offer. And this is going to be the foundation, the basis of feudalism. Okay? Feudalism was a type of government in which the political power was exercised locally by private individuals rather than by the agents of a centralized state. Now that's a key point. Without a centralized state, who's going to increase even more in power? The Pope. So feudalism actually is the best thing that could have ever happened to the papacy. Because as you have individual, localized rulers who are not organized on a larger scale into any massive centralized government, the power of the papacy is just going to increase even more because there's not going to be any one of these individuals who's strong enough to threaten the power of the Pope. You follow that? One popular text explains it this way. Fully developed feudalism was a fusion of three basic elements. A personal element called lordship or vassalage, in which one nobleman, the vassal, became the loyal follower of a stronger nobleman, the lord. Number two, the property element, called fief or fief, usually land, which the vassal received from his lord to enable him to fulfill the obligations of vassalage. And three, the governmental element, meaning that private exercise of governmental functions over vassals and fiefs. Central to feudalism was the personal bond between lord and vassal. In a ceremony known as the Act of Homage, the vassal knelt before his lord and promised to be his man. The feudal contract thus entered into by lord and vassal was considered sacred and binding upon both parties. Breaking ties of mutual obligation was considered a felony because it was the fundamental bond of early medieval society. The lord, for his part, was obligated to give his vassal protection and justice, and the vassal's primary duty was for military service. With no clear central authority, the Catholic Church and the power of the papacy continued to grow. Okay? Now we've got a few minutes before 10 o'clock. Does anybody have any questions or comments about the lesson?
No,
Well, another thing in history too that's a total misnomer is how many times did the popes overlook or sanction the divorce or adultery of tons of other kings in Europe? Well, the thing that was going on with Henry was Luther. Luther had already opened the can of worms, and when Henry came along with what he wanted to do, the Pope wasn't having anything of it. You know that Henry VIII, wrote a pamphlet declaring Luther a heretic and was given some sort of a recognition by the Pope as being a defender of the faith. Henry was a staunch Catholic before all that stuff happened with it. Yeah.
Another modern day thing about even the strength of the Catholic Church today. And yes, if Henry died, I know he went to the Pope and got special stuff. So he was kind of a radical and spent life too to make sure that, you know, he was going to go to heaven. So I think that crystal still is in place. And people are afraid without it.
Well, if you're in that system, yeah. I was talking, Craig was, some of you have been around for a while in the assembly, we had some Spanish tracts. You might remember this, Ernie. And there's a high percentage of the folks at Hines that speak Spanish, and Craig brought some of these tracts to some of the people at work, and most, I'm not trying to be, you know, most Latino people are Catholic. Why is that? Because when the Spanish conquistadors came over to the New World, they always brought with them what? Jesuit priests. Okay? And so all of Mexico, Central America, South America, the predominant religion is Roman Catholic, because when those regions were settled by Europeans, they were settled by the Spanish, who were predominantly Roman Catholic. Okay? But anyway, my point is that it says on the tract that salvation is a free gift, and the reaction is that can't be the case. You have to do all these things, you know, which is still what the church teaches. Now I want to be clear about something. Is it possible that within the Catholic Church there are true believers?
Yes.
Yes. But did they get saved by believing the teaching and doctrine of that church?
No.
Because the teaching and doctrine of that church is that you have to keep, still to this day, that the sacraments are a means of grace, and that you have to participate in the sacraments to bestow grace upon the sinner. Yeah.
Back in the Dark Ages, how many people do you think that went along with the Catholicism, that still were true believers, but refused, you know, that went under the guise of being a Catholic to save their own lives.
It's hard to say.
Because under the threat of death, you could be a true believer, but, you know, if your father wanted to protect your family, you'll have to save their lives.
I would say that the majority of the true believers, though, Beverly, as you'll see as we go through the next few weeks, were willing as the martyrs of old to die for what they believed. And they died in large numbers. Whether you're talking about the Paulicians or the Waldensians or some of these other groups that we'll talk about over the next, the Carpi, they're all dying and being persecuted by this organized religious church as being heretics because they don't agree with the church's doctrine. And these, see, that's, remember way back when, lesson 6 when I talked about the challenge of church history? This is the challenge, because The majority of the history is written from the point of view of the winners. And who are the winners, the majority of this time period? The Catholic Church. Okay? So, they'll call some of the groups we're going to look at heretics, but as we've already seen, if you study what they actually believe, they're a lot more like you and I than the church that's persecuting them as heretics. Yeah. Yeah. So you don't hear about
it.
You don't hear about this stuff as much. But they still will. You still hear about it's still fundamentally the same church. Now, until recently they've stepped back from some of their rhetoric for a while, but I don't think any of it has fundamentally changed. Okay? We gotta quit. So, thanks for your time.